ebook publishers and marketing services company Just Imagine It, Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, a new fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes and right here locally on KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, 89.5 FM. Art and entertainment news and views. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join the Downpour Audiobook Club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $14.99 per month, that's Downpour.com. On this episode, from Scream Queen to writer-producer, actress Kim Kopf tells us about her acting career and her upcoming film Funhouse. Oregon's own Lost Maven stops by our studio to sing a few songs and talk about their new album, Song for Hungry Souls, and why is it that the head is always missing? Find out in this audiobook feature, right after the news you want to know.
Charlie Stanton.
I'm Maya Seligman.
And I'm Cyrus Emerson. Here's a look at our top stories in the art and entertainment world. Angus T. Jones' future with Two and a Half Men remains uncertain after his rant against a CBS sitcom went viral last week. But it's clear that a lot of people remain baffled by the 19-year-old actor's decision to call the show that pays him $350,000 an episode filth, among them CBS's CEO. CBS and Warner Brothers, the studio that produces Two and a Half Men, have declined to officially comment on the situation, but a source close to the show told ABCNews.com that Jones isn't expected on the set anytime soon, because his character doesn't appear for the next two episodes. He has recently joined the Army. If Jones does get the axe, he may find a new gig with Sheen, the Two and a Half Men star who was booted from the sitcom last year. I guess Sheen said that he can join the show, anytime, and come on as maybe a patient. He plays a psychiatrist, right?
Yeah, he does play a psychiatrist, and it sounds like old Angus, or young Angus, needs a little counseling on the couch there, because, you know, I mean, let's face it, man, if you're making $300,000 a week, and you're like, you know what, this isn't any good. You know, Matthew Perry had quite a take on that, too. It was a thing he did on Funny or Die, where he did a video in response to Angus T.
Matthew Perry, that sounds funny. I want to hear. Let's hear it.
Yeah, let's do that.
Don't watch my show. I want you to stop watching NBC's Go On. Great, so because I think all of my TV shows were immoral, I'm going to give all the money back. I assume that's what Angus is going to do.
Maybe we should stop the tape and start over.
No, we're not stopping anything. Note to the editor, don't edit any of this out. I want to keep this real. So, all the money I'm making from Go On, I'm giving it back. From Mr. Sunshine, giving it back. Studio 60, giving it back.
What about Friends?
What do you think, I'm a moron? I'm having a spiritual awakening. I'm not an idiot. I'm keeping the Friends money.
Yeah, if you gave all the money back from Friends, you might have to go wash dishes or something.
Yeah, you might have to actually work at Central Park.
Well, talk about feuds. There was an unexpected one on a recent episode of the NBC talent show, The Voice. Maroon 5 vocalist Adam Levine took a moment to slam the West Hollywood club, The Roxy. Why, you might ask?
Okay, why?
Why? Well, apparently the club didn't give the band a dressing room. The jab came while Levine and his coaching peers were giving comments to contestant Cassidy Pope, the former lead singer of the Florida rock band Hey Monday. Pope had just completed a rendition of Michelle Branch's Are You Happy Now, and the song appeared to trigger an unhappy memory for Levine. He got really testy, saying, We used to open for Michelle Branch. I remember we opened for her at the Roxy and they didn't even give us a dressing room. I hate the Roxy. I'll never play there again.
Wow.
Whoa.
Yeah, those are pretty strong words.
Yeah, they are.
And yeah, I'm thinking, what does he need a dressing room for anyway? All he ever wears is ripped jeans and a t-shirt.
if he
even wears a shirt.
Yeah. Yeah, why would he need it? Well, Pope, she had actually experienced playing at the club herself, and she tried to protest, and she said she loved the Roxy. But Levine didn't let up, firing back with, "Oh, the Roxy is horrible. Don't ever go there." And then when the audience started to chatter, Levine justified his rant and said, "They screwed us over, and now they're paying for it." So, of course, watching the pop stars give off-the-cuff advice and commentary is actually really part of the appeal of The Voice. And the Roxy seemed willing to have some fun with the rant. They tweeted a photo of its marquee, which contained a message saying, "Adam Levine, your dressing room is ready."
How cool is that?
And then there was actually a follow-up tweet from the Roxy, and it appeared to have been deleted, but it sarcastically read, "Bands need dressing rooms," with the hashtag note to self. Pretty funny.
You know, that's like, that is trippy about Adam Levine, because he, you know, I mean, now that he's a big star, you know, he's kind of like, you know, remembers, you know, like, "Hey, man, before we were, you know, Maroon 5, you know.
Or The Voice, before he was on The Voice."
Yeah, he had no voice.
He has a voice now, loud and clear.
And a dressing room, I guess.
I have a feeling The Voice gives him a dressing room, yeah.
Yeah, well, he needs it.
Adam Levine, you should send out an email like the guy from NYU did. Don't you have that a little bit more about that, Charlie?
You know, actually, I do, and it's really kind of crazy. There's an NYU student, and he sent out a reply and went out to 40,000 classmates. Max Wetzler, a sophomore at New York University, was simply trying to forward an email from the bursar's office to his mother on Monday. Instead, Wetzler accidentally hit reply all and CC'd 39,979 of his fellow NYU students in the process.
Oopsies.
Wetzler, realizing what he had done, fired off a quick apology. But his email triggered a rare university-wide revelation. "We simultaneously realized that any message, complaint, whim, link, video could be sent to nearly 40,000 people in an instance, and thousands of students did." Man, how trippy is that?
That is so funny.
Yeah, like, so people were sending off emails like, "So how's everyone today? Does anyone have a pencil I could borrow?"
And then I heard that one of them said, "Would you rather fight 100 duck-sized horses or one horse-sized duck?" Yeah, it's pretty good to see the weighty philosophical kind of questions that these students are asking themselves in their spare time.
Yeah, you know, yeah, that's proof, you know, that all that tuition money is, you know, getting a lot of use down there, and they're using it properly.
Yeah, well, NYU is supposed to be a pretty prestigious place, so. But I can't even send 50 people on my Hotmail. I think it maxes out at 50, so.
Hotmail? People still use Hotmail? Now that's commitment. Well, CC me that on my AOL account, you know?
You got it.
I'm still waiting for that guy to keep saying, "You got mail." Yeah, that's crazy about the emails, you know. But you know what? Another thing that probably everyone is talking about down at NYU campus, because he's very, very popular down there, is Jack White. And he has a brand new album out. And, you know, I got to say, you know, I really like his music. I like him more as a solo artist than I did with the White Stripes. So, Cyrus, you have a little something about that, don't you?
I do. The first line of Blunderbuss, the debut solo album from former White Stripes singer Jack White, arrives with a lyrical punch in the face. "I was in the shower, so I could not tell my nose was bleeding," he sings.
Oh, wow.
"After such a greeting, one can't help but wonder about the journey ahead. How will the 36-year-old fare over the next 13 songs when he's already drawn his own blood? Bodily concerns aside, White's a Renaissance man to be sure, but he's also a purist of sorts who fancies basic rock structures and tunings and harbors a general disinterest in music tech advances, artificial sounds, or remixes." Like the Adventure Club or something, you know, techno. I guess he's not into it. Hmm. He's more of the old rock and roll kind of guy, like the Rolling Stones or Led Zeppelin and The Who have left a power vacuum as they've gotten older and started to retire. So Jack White is filling that void and has definitely brought rock and roll music to a new generation.
Yeah, he's kind of brought it back to the basics. You know, 3-4 chord progression, a little lead thrown in. And he's got these, you know, crazy, thrilling lyrics, you know. I mean, I love that, you know. They, mm-hmm. I was in the shower. I didn't know my nose was bleeding.
Shouldn't he be Jack Red if his nose is bleeding? Yeah,
really. Maybe he did that for Christmas, you know.
Maybe, yeah. But he's got a lot of style. He's got lots of style. The video, I mean, he's got a great suit. Everybody's dressed to the nines. And the album is nominated for a Grammy this year.
That's so, right, except for Best Rock Album.
A lot of success for Jack White.
Mm, that'll be fun to see what happens.
He's, you know, speaking of successful guys, no one other than maybe the people that make Chanel No. 5 are more popular than Brad Pitt.
Oh, right. Yeah. Have you ever wondered how much cash a Hollywood star like Brad Pitt carries in his wallet?
I should have asked him last time I saw him.
Oh, yeah. Well, apparently it's more than 1,000 big ones.
Right on. You can pick up the lunch tab.
Yeah, exactly. He would probably be happy to because... the amount has been revealed not because Pitt was bragging, that's not his style, but because he used it actually in his latest act of kindness on Thanksgiving Day. According to People magazine, Pitt donated all the money in his wallet, which happened to be $1,100, to a fundraiser for the UK's Southampton General Hospital neonatal unit. The BBC reported that Pitt made the donation when a woman named Trisha Wilson-Hughes was soliciting donations from the crew of Pitt's film, World War Z, which was filming near a gift shop where she works. She approached Pitt's bodyguard for a contribution, and she was stunned when he returned a few minutes later with Pitt's cash. Ms. Wilson-Hughes shared, "I couldn't believe it. I was completely dumbstruck. He said if he had more, he would have given it. I said, honestly, that's more than enough, but if he wants to do anything in the future, that's absolutely fine. You hear negative stories about A-listers, but I won't hear a wrong word against him. I'm in awe of him." That's what she said. The woman, she actually really cared about the neonatal unit because that's where her best friend's baby was treated. Zachary Gallagher, who's now about 5 months old, was born with a hernia and was in intensive care for 9 weeks. His mom, Carly, told the story. This is interesting of how she found out. Wilson-Hughes called her, and at first she was just saying they got a small donation. And then, as Carly recounted, "I thought she was messing about and was going to say, my dad's given you a fiver or something. Then she said, it's from Brad Pitt. He thought it was a really good cause. The silver lining is that Zachary is home and alive. To have Brad assist us is more than we could have ever wished for."
What a great story.
Yeah.
Well, Brad Pitt and his fiancée, Angelina Jolie, are definitely known for their compassion. They've given to all sorts
She's
of different causes.
She's a compassionate
causes.
Woman.
Yeah.
No, she really is. Yeah. I know your mind is going with that, because, you know, she's such a sexy star, but now she does so much, you know, charity work, and mm-hmm. I think she was ambassador for UNICEF.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, globally. She really helps out globally and has mm-hmm. adopted children.
Yeah.
And
many.
You know, yeah. And her and Brad take care of both of them. So
I just, I was, 17.
I get adopted. You know, it's funny. Have you guys seen the Chanel ad that Brad Pitt recently
did? I've heard so much about
it.
I saw it.
Was so funny because I saw an SNL Saturday Night Live skit on it, and it almost exactly matches, but it's just hilarious how they make fun of it. He got $7 million for it, and the top comment on Chanel's YouTube page is, "Incredibly awkward, uncomfortable to watch."
Really? I'll have to watch that, you know?
Yeah. I thought it was pretty good.
Not there's anything wrong with it, man.
It's like, I guess
it's
it depends on what angle.
To see him in a commercial because, you know, he's a big movie star. And I was just watching TV.
I always thought Chanel was just a perfume for women.
I think Brad Pitt is actually the first male that representative
of it. Is that why he grew his hair long?
Bringing out his femininity.
He's going back to the Interview with the Vampire.
Yeah, that's right. Moving on from Brad Pitt and Chanel No. 5, get your tissues ready because Alicia Keys had an incredible opportunity to have the Empire State Building in New York City displayed brand new with an honest-to-gosh, chilling, beautiful LED light show synchronized to her songs Girl on Fire and Empire State of Mind. Now, I happened to see that, and you can see it, you know, on YouTube. I saw it then.
I saw it, too.
I saw it, too, because you sent it to me.
How cool was that?
Yeah, quite spectacular.
Yeah. You know, and Alicia Keys, she's quite a singer. I love that song, Empire State of Mind. I guess everybody from New York has a song about New York. You know, Billy Joel, Frank Sinatra, you know. Anyway, and it was celebrating her latest album, Girl on Fire, which was dropping this last Tuesday, and... that's a great song, Girl on Fire. You know, it just got one of those great choruses. You know, this girl's on fire. And
full of energy.
Yeah, it is full of energy. And then it kind of goes into more of a melodic song, you know, which I just, you know, listen to it so I can hear the chorus again because it's so
catchy. Well, that's on a Visa commercial too.
Is it?
Yeah, this girl is on fire. She hits that in a Visa commercial.
Oh, interesting how songs are getting filtered into all sorts of marketing.
Yep. Yeah, you know, I love the way they lit up the Empire State Building. It was just, you know, amazing to see that, you know?
All the different colors.
And it was a very clear night, too. And so I had an opportunity, you know, when I was watching it, to think about, you know, Christy McIntyre, who's our New York correspondent.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so I'm like, hey, you know what? I got to get a hold of Christy and see.
What's going on out there in the Eastern Seaboard? I got to tell you, you guys got a lot of things going on there. How you doing, Christy?
Hey, good. Thanks, Charlie. How are you?
I'm unbelievable. Unbelievable. It's Christmas time. What else?
I know, exactly. Hey, well, it's exciting news for us podcasters. MTV is going to launch a new talk show this fall starring comedians Nikki Glaser and Sarah Schaefer. And they're the hosts of a very successful podcast called You Had to Be There. And it features the two women chatting about the perils of everyday life with each other and usually a guest, somebody from the world of comedy, normally. They are two comedians, after all. But unlike the podcast, the show that they're going to do for MTV is going to feature the duo in comedy sketches, performing pre-written jokes, and conducting probably a little bit more traditional interviews. And Glaser and Schaefer, who both tour the country performing stand-up comedy, began recording the podcast in Schaefer's Brooklyn apartment after they met in 2010. So they're just in their apartment in Brooklyn recording. But soon, the pair will move from Clinton Hill to Times Square, where their new show will be filmed in the former Total Request Live studio. Do you remember that from the TV show with Carson Daly? And they're actually going to be looking out onto Times Square if they, if it's still the same kind of setup. I don't know if you've ever seen that, Charlie.
Yeah, no, I have.
So that would be really exciting. I mean, to have it, you know, doing their show kind of in front of an audience, basically, in Times Square.
Seems to be the motif, you know, with the, you see it on Good Morning America, you see it on all the reality shows.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you know, get everybody involved in it type of thing.
There's something about people screaming in the background that really adds to a show.
Yeah, I guess.
All the fans outside with their signs and screaming. So Schaefer told the Huffington Post, "I'm beyond excited. I think what I'm most excited about is getting to work every day with my bestie, Nikki, and bring our vibe to the MTV audience." She said, "My earliest memory of watching television was MTV, and I can't believe I get to be part of it now," which is pretty exciting because that's pretty much my first memory of television of
MTV?
Yeah. Not television, but cable. Just watching cable. It was like, that's all I ever watched was MTV.
Yeah, that's when they showed music videos?
Yeah. That's when, when we actually watch music on MTV. Yeah. So their show is going to be called The Nikki and Sarah Show, and it's the latest entry in this trend of comedy podcasts becoming television shows. Which is very exciting, considering we are in the podcasting business.
I think Cyrus should maybe, you should start your own video podcast thing and see if MTV picks it up for you.
Maybe. Well, I started filming today with the promo with you two.
Oh, there you go.
You know, that's
you look great.
Great
today, Maya. I mean, you could definitely be on a MTV series.
Oh, thank you, Cyrus. It must be my shoes.
What am I, chopped liver?
You're just a
pretty We could
face.
Do a video series with Cyrus, rapping Cy Emerson, and you know, you tune in every week to see how much his cornrows have actually grown.
And actually, I found out in rehearsal, I have to tell you, Charlie, that Cyrus not only is a great rapper, but he was singing Rolling Stones songs, and he sounded great.
I was, yeah, Angie.
Oh, wow.
He knew lyrics.
It's one of my favorites.
Is it?
Yeah. And there are many other great songs by the Rolling Stones, who made their triumphant return to the London stage on Sunday night in the first of five concerts to mark the 50th anniversary of their debut as an American-oriented blues band. They showed no signs of wear and tear as frontman Mick Jagger swaggered and strutted through a stellar 2.5-hour show. He looked remarkably trim and fit and was in top vocal form. Jagger took time out from singing to thank the crowd for its loyalty. "It's amazing that we're still doing this, and it's amazing that you're still buying our records and coming to our shows," he said. "Thank you, thank you, thank you."
I wonder if Keith Richards wrote that for him.
Well, that's one thing about Jagger. He always is very
gracious
host. Mm-hmm. Like on Saturday Night Live, when he hosted Saturday Night Live, he wasn't afraid to make fun of himself and you know.
But humility, yeah. That's nice.
Yeah, you know, I saw that episode, and I know what you're talking about, because he came out and said, you know, he went to a nightclub, right? And he's an old dude, and which he is, and he's watching Mick Jagger impersonators on stage.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, he says, that doesn't sound like Mick Jagger. And they're like, oh, come on.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, he is a really gracious guy. I saw him do the introduction for the Beatles into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Oh, and he did that?
He did it, yeah. And they were there, and he was just so, he was charismatic, and he was very funny. You know, he came out there, and he had George Harrison next to him and Ringo Starr, and he was getting ready to introduce him to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And he goes, yeah, I remember when we first got started. He goes, it was the Beatles. They were the Beatles, and we were nothing. And they actually helped us get a recording contract and wrote our first hit song for us. And he goes, and I remember seeing them. He goes, and we would go into clubs to see them play. He goes, and one time, he goes, we were playing on stage, and then they walked in. He goes, and there they were. The Fab Four, the four-headed monster. In those days, they never went anywhere, you know, as a group. You know, and he goes, and they were all wearing these black leather trench coats. And that's when I said, I have to learn how to write songs.
Oh, that'd be a great way to get inspired.
Yeah. Well, what a year for in England. You also had the Queen's Diamond Jubilee.
That's right, and the Olympics.
The Olympics, the new James Bond film. So they just got in under the wire with this right before the end of the year, because I guess things are kind of slowing down for them. But it wasn't a very emotional reunion, because some of their old bandmates came back, Bill Wyman and Mick Taylor.
Right, yeah. Bill Wyman, great bass player, and you know, they're a great band. You know, they have a new album out, and it actually sounds a lot like their old albums, but it's amazing that they, at their age, that they still sound, you know, fresh.
Yeah. And they have such classics, too. A number of songs.
Like Angie.
Angie. That's right. I really like Wild Horses myself.
I like Wild Horses, too.
The other day, it got stuck in my head, and all day it was going through my head, because it just has that passion, you know.
There's so many of them. They just go on and on. I like Brown Sugar and, you know, Jumpin' Jack Flash. And
you can't always get what you want.
Right.
But you try sometimes.
Exactly. Right. You just might find.
You get what you need.
You know, I try and I try and I try and I try and I try. That's what can get me now.
Satisfaction.
No, girl with action. Hey, hey, hey. That's what I say.
It's kind of like Across the Universe, only with Rolling Stones songs.
Oh.
And we aren't quite singing.
Yeah.
It's a gas, gas, gas. Strangely enough, Adam Levine and Alicia Keys did a cover of Wild Horses.
Did they have a dressing room?
No, they actually had to do it on horses. So there was no dressing room.
They had a pasture.
They did have a pasture. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they were saying that, you know, the people from the Roxies, that they just couldn't keep them away.
Well, you know, Mick Jagger, actually, there's a really good picture of him that I saw the other day.
Somebody took a picture of Mick Jagger?
Yes. And he had this really humble smile on his face. It was a beautiful picture. And guess who took it? You'll never guess.
Adam Levine.
That would be funny. Brian Adams.
That's how you got the moves like Jagger.
Brian Adams.
Yeah, Brian Adams is not only, you're probably familiar with him as the Canadian hit maker responsible for those 80s and 90s classics such as Cuts Like a Knife, Summer of 69, Run to You, and Please Forgive Me.
He did a song for Robin Hood, right?
He did a song for Don Juan DeMarcos, too, the Johnny Depp Marlon Brando movie.
Okay.
Mm. Well, the interesting thing is that he has another equally successful career. He's actually a multi-talented artist, because he's a very in-demand top photographer who's shot hundreds of portraits of fellow rock stars as well as film and fashion celebrities. He just released a volume of his favorite photos called Exposed, and it boasts a staggering list of A-list names, both classic and modern, who were captured by his lens. In the music world alone, there was Michael Jackson, Sting, Morrissey, Billy Idol, and many others, and, you know, Mick Jagger, as I mentioned. I also saw a really great picture of Amy Winehouse. She was in a blue bikini, so really striking photos.
Before tattoos or after?
After, definitely.
You know, I saw a thing with Amy Winehouse where when she first was getting started, right? The first couple of years, and when she was getting famous, and She didn't have any tattoos. I didn't know that. I thought she had them coming up.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're definitely captured in the photo by Brian Adams. Yeah. He actually told CNN, "The whole thing sort of started through documenting my own work. I started doing pictures for my own album covers." And from there, he rapidly moved into capturing others. An interesting story. He even managed to literally expose pop star Pink in his latest book, literally, because as he shared, "I said to her at the end of the day, the light's really beautiful. Let's go upstairs in the sunlight and do some pictures outside." And boom, her shirt came off.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I guess he just brings that out of people.
Yeah, he yeah. must. Well, he actually was laughing when he was interviewed on CNN, and he said that his secret weapon, his secret, is whiskey. It's like, yep, I think that might help
his
subjects get a little looser.
I'll tell you what, whiskey has made many a woman's shirt come off. Sunlight or not.
If you're speaking from experience, that sounds a little... do you really want that reputation, Charlie? And that's your art and entertainment news. Keep listening for Blackstone's special feature.
You run around on the rebound. Everyone says you're going all the way down. Out of your mind all of the time. Stare at the wall. She's got it all now.
Kim Kopp, known best for her work with Oscar-winning director Andrew Stanton in the Pixar film WALL-E, spoke with me from a beach in Hawaii. And I got to tell you, it was a great conversation. And she's quite an actress.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting episode of Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, another great interview. Today, we're talking with actress slash producer Kim Kopp, and she's currently in Hawaii. Welcome, Kim.
Hi. Welcome. Aloha.
Yeah, aloha, as they say. Yeah. For all of our listeners out there, Kim's been in quite a few motion pictures and television, and sounds like you've switched gears a little bit and kind of went into producing.
Correct, yes. I just decided that I was passionate about a few projects and I really wanted to be hands-on with them, so I decided to go the producing route, and I'm really happy thus far. And currently I'm working on a horror film that I actually originally wrote, and I got a couple of really great writers. One of the writers is with South Park, and he did Gingerbread Man 3, and another writer, Jonathan Baca. The three of us are rewriting Funhouse, and it's really great. The script is almost done. I'm producing with an actress friend of mine, Tuesday Night. People might recognize her from Nightmare on Elm Street, Leah Stoltz. And it's a really great project, and we're really excited about it. We'll be filming in the beginning of the year.
And where are you going to be filming that? What location?
We're going to be filming in Lake Arrowhead.
Oh, cool place.
Great locations there. Yeah. And then in the greater Los Angeles area. So we keep it local, which is really nice for the economy there.
Yeah. And for our listeners out there who don't know where Lake Arrowhead is, it's in the outside of Los Angeles. I think it's technically in Los Angeles County or San Bernardino County. It's north of Los Angeles in the mountains. And it's a beautiful lake out there. It's a really nice area by Big Bear and all that.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. And the script, it takes place, it's called Funhouse, and it takes place in a small community area, and it actually has an amusement park, a rundown amusement park in it. So there's a really great location up in Lake Arrowhead that actually has a rundown, not being used, amusement park area. So it's actually perfect for our location.
Great. You know, I wanted to ask you, you know, where you got your ideas for your films and things like that, because I've noticed as an actress, you know, you've been in all kinds of, you know, I saw the Searching for Ron Fikes, which is hysterical. I got to tell you. I mean, that was.
Thanks.
That was great.
I wanted to laugh, and I wrote that, you know what, it's going to be really just, I wanted to have a fun project to do. And it turned out great, and I got to work with a lot of my friends, and it's about dating in L.A., two Jersey girls come out, you know, from Jersey, and they're like excited and they're trying to be the perfect woman. Uh-huh. And yeah, it was really a lot of fun.
You know that there's a scene in there for our listeners where you're listening to on the car radio, and yeah. And the guy's going, you know, are you one of those people, you know, that just sits on the couch, gets shovels in from the ice cream carton? And, you know, yeah. You know, of course, you know, we can all identify with that, because I'm like, oh, man, how does he know? You know, and,
yeah.
You know, and your response in the film, it was just like so classic, because you're like, I could change.
I know. I'm one of those people.
Yeah.
Change.
Yeah. It was hysterical.
I know. It was funny. Yeah, that was a really fun scene to shoot. Yeah, I love that. But I'm really excited about Funhouse. We have a really great director, Gabriel Bologna,
uh-huh.
And his parents, Renee Taylor and Joseph Bologna. They're very famous actors. They've worked a lot, and they're actually playwrights also. But anyway, they're going to be in it.
Oh, wow.
And we're still looking, yeah, we're still looking for a male lead. So I have to, you know, keep you informed in that. We don't have anybody set yet, so we're still looking.
Okay, I'll send you my address.
Okay, great. Yeah.
No, I got to ask you this one question. You worked on WALL-E, right? The movie WALL-E?
I did.
How did you like that?
I loved it. Andrew Stanton was so wonderful, the director.
Uh-huh.
And it was such a great project to work on. You know, Disney, Pixar, Disney. It was like a dream come true.
So what was how'd you like working with Andrew?
He's wonderful. He's such a sweet, sweet person. Really easy to work with. Really humble, great guy. I can't speak highly enough about him. He's a really great person.
Yeah.
And I had a great time. And it's fun because it's a kids movie, and I never did a kids movie before, and, you know, Pixar, Disney. So it was just a different route, and I really enjoyed doing it, and I feel really blessed that I got the opportunity to work on that.
So tell me more about Funhouse. You know, I mean, what's the plot of it?
Well, it takes place in a small town, and I don't want to give too much away, but I actually originally wrote it as a therapy for myself because I was going through something really traumatic with a really close person in my life, and I felt helpless in the situation, and I didn't know what to do, and I just started writing, and it was really therapeutic, and then all of a sudden I thought, well, you know what, I might as well keep going with this, and I ended up writing a screenplay. Then I shopped it around, and it had really good response. I had it at Universal. They loved it, but then always, like, something will happen, and I just kind of let go of it, and I thought, well, it served its purpose. I wrote it, and I had the therapy. It helped me organize thoughts in my mind, and it just helped me a lot. And then I had some people read it, and they said, you know what? Actually, my friend Leah Stoltz, who's producing with me, she said, we need to rewrite this and really make it a horror movie. And Gabriel Bologna said the same thing, the director. He's like, let's make Funhouse a horror movie. So I got these amazing writers through my manager, Abraxas Talent Terry. He has these great writers, and, you know, it just met with them. They loved the ideas that I had to change it into the horror, and we just, from there, it just started happening. And we're almost done writing it, and it's just going to be a great, great story, and it's going to be really scary. So everybody has to go see it.
Well, you know, I'm certainly going to go see it. When do you think it will come out? Sometime next year? Or?
Yeah, we're going to start filming in the beginning of the year, so next year definitely. Yeah, it'll take us about maybe a month and a half, 2 months to film, then it'll go into editing. So maybe the middle of the year, next year to the end of the year, it'll be out.
Great. We'll be looking forward to that. You've been in a lot of big movies and a lot of TV series. What was, like, something that just stands out for you that, like, you know, oh, I really like doing that, or, you know, I'm so glad I got to work on that?
I think the movie Zig Zag was one of my favorites. I had a great character part in that. I played actually a white trash backwoods killer, and it was a lot, you know, and I was one of the leads in that. And Dan Reed, He was great. He actually wrote it, and Alan Noss, the director. We shot it up in Portland, Oregon.
Hey!
I love Oregon. I absolutely loved it. And being on location up there, it was just amazing. We shot a lot on Mount Hood and then all the surrounding areas. And I just really had a blast. Yeah. We were up there in the summer. We shot it in July or June and July. So I got to be up there for the fireworks.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what river that is. North of Portland.
The Columbia.
The Columbia, that's right. The Columbia. And the best fireworks I've ever seen. I mean, it must have gone off for about 45 minutes. I couldn't believe it. You know, and I've seen pretty good fireworks. I mean, I'm from the East Coast, so I've been in New York during 4th of July, and I've seen those, and doesn't even come close to those fireworks that were up in Oregon.
Well, that's because we basically got nothing else to do. So.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a big deal to them, right?
Yeah, it is. You know what? It really is. 4th of July is huge all across the state of Oregon. There's two big holidays out here, 4th of July and Halloween.
Oh, and Halloween. There you go.
And we have a film festival here. We'll have to get your film shown here.
Oh, definitely. Yes, definitely. And again, I don't want to give too much away. The writers are going to get mad at me. But it actually takes place, Funhouse, during 4th of July.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so there you go. Yeah.
Where can people find out about all your new projects, your new film Funhouse, and all your past projects? You have a website, do you not?
I do. It's kimkopf.com, so check it out. And you can always follow me on Twitter, Kim Kopf on Twitter. And, of course, Facebook, Kim Kopf. So there you go.
Well, you certainly made it hard enough for us.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah. All right, Kim. Well, you know what? It's been really great visiting with you, and we really look forward to seeing Funhouse when it comes out. You know, movie theater near you sometime in 2013. And
that sounds great.
Yeah, and then you can check out Kim on justimagineinc.com and also on her website, kimkopf, KOPF.com. And thank you so much for being on here.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a pleasure. I really enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Okay. I'll tell you what, Kim, you got to do us a favor. When your movie comes out, come back on. Tell us all about it.
I sure will. I definitely will. And I'll bring my other crew. I'll bring my other two producers. They're a hoot. You'll love them.
To learn more about Kim, visit us at our website at justimagineinc.com.
Mistress Wood's as cold as stone. Can't bring me down, can't stop my flow. No, 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 no. Wisdom that the river shows.
Lost Maven's music is as beautiful as the two sexy gals on vocals. They demonstrated the power of their style live in the studio with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of Get Behind Me, Not Stay There. Today, we have a great interview, and we're going to have some great live music with Lost Maven from Ashland, Oregon. Hey, welcome, you guys.
Hey.
Hey, thank you.
How are you guys been in all this crazy weather out here?
Good. I'm ready to go snow skiing, so I'm appreciating the cold weather.
Oh, okay. Okay, so we have Veronica.
Hi.
Greta.
Hello.
And Matt.
Hey.
And your drummer couldn't make
Scott,
it.
Yeah.
He's volunteering in New York with the emerging catastrophe that Veronica perpetrated with her friend Sandy. So, you want to tell us about that?
I have no comment.
Okay. Well, you know, as I told you guys before, I heard about you. You know, some friends had recommended that I listen to you, and I got your album, and I listened to it, and it was really, really good. I bought it, and then we went and saw you in Jacksonville Springs, and, you know, you guys were great. You know, and then I spent a lot of time chasing Greta around, and they're like,
yeah.
Can we do this? Can we do this?
We've been trying to do it like, for a while.
Sure, dude.
Yeah.
And but now you guys finally made it, so... You know, thank you so much for, you know, showing and let's hear a little bit about your music. You know, where you, you know, where you record, and you know what you're going to be working on in the future.
Yeah. So we like to go out with Mr. Bob Pagano at Mountain View Productions and do a recording out there at this old converted little schoolhouse.
That's in Grants Pass?
Yes, and there's a mini horse in the back named Dixie.
Oh.
Our new best friend.
Yeah.
Now, does Dixie actually play on the album?
Yeah.
We got a picture with her.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Did you have the hat on where you did like the pony ride?
No.
Next time, maybe. That's a good idea.
And we like to try to get as much of a live sound on our recordings as possible. Mm-hmm.
Well, before we get too involved with the interview, why don't you first of all tell everybody where they can find your music and how they can purchase it.
Matt, I
know you have a Facebook page, and I think you're also on Rhapsody?
Reverb Nation.
Oh, Reverb Nation. Yeah. That's right. That's
well, pretty much lostmaven.com is the portal to everything. So, you know, we're all over the internet, but that's how you get to pretty much all of our sites. And we're on Bandcamp if you like lossless audio. Are we on iTunes yet or no?
I don't think so.
We will be soon, though.
Thanks, iTunes, yet.
But, yeah, so Bandcamp is probably the best source right now, but just go to lostmaven.com. It's real easy. And you can listen to the whole album for free online, too. So.
Oh, okay.
As well as purchase it.
Mm-hmm. I purchased it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I was going to remember the Reverb Nation is where I bought it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Which is cool. It's a cool site, too.
Yeah.
Yeah,
which, you know, the first song I heard about you guys was Dusty Rose, and it was like kind of a, you know, upbeat, you know, had like a really good groove to it, and I liked it, so, you know, I you know, went and, you know, bought your album, listened to the whole thing, and I was like, wow, you guys are kind of diverse. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, we all come from different places musically, that's for sure.
Yeah.
We really dig each other's styles a lot, but the things that we listen to on our own, like,
are really different.
Pretty funny.
Yeah,
we're very different.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about your different styles.
Well, you want to start, B?
Okay. I listen to like a lot of heavy electronic music on my own, and I also
give me an example.
I don't know. There's a song called "Crave You" by the Adventure Club remix, something like that. That's a really good track that I've been listening to lately. But I also have a passion for singer-songwriter stuff, so I bring kind of a singer-songwriter edge to our music.
Along with a little bit of hip-hop, I'd say.
With a little hip-hop, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. and Greta?
I tend to listen to a lot of singer-songwriter, folk, and bluegrass. Sometimes even country. and I like, you know, rock and roll, definitely.
Yeah.
And what else? Yeah, and I also like jam bands. And that's
give us an example.
She went on String Cheese tour
this
summer.
Yeah, I love String Cheese.
Oh, really?
I'll be there in Denver for New Year's, too. And then, yeah, I like Fish and rock bands. Let's see, I really like... Like Heart and, you know, classic rock stuff, but also, you know, like the Scissor Sisters and some of the newer stuff. And then, yeah, bluegrass. I love Yonder Mountain String Band.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And they're fun.
Yeah.
All right, that brings us to Matt.
I listen to nerd music mostly.
I didn't even know anybody bought my album.
Nerd. I'm a fan.
Yeah.
A lot of progressive rock, even progressive metal, Rush, Dream Theater, Between the Buried and Me lately, they're heavier, but they're really interesting. I like them a lot. So I definitely bring maybe a heavier side to the band at times. But also, I really, really love blues rock.
Blues rock?
Yeah, so like the Stevie Ray Vaughan style. I pretty much grew up on that, so that's kind of what I bring.
Well, that's quite a, you know, diverse you know, thing you got going on.
Yeah, we don't get to hang out because of it. But
and since the drummer's not here, I will fill in for him. And, you know, I listen to a lot of Lost Maven.
He actually is a jazz drummer.
Yeah.
So that's what he went to college and did jazz drumming.
Yeah, he's very jazz and funk.
Scott Magicaro is his name.
So when you put us four together, you get an eclectic mix of Lost Maven.
But I really appreciate the Lost Maven sound. It does have that rock heart, like, big guitar, just like groove, melody.
Well, you know, the standard question for every band is, you know, what do you prefer, studio work or live performances?
live. I appreciate the different aspects of both.
I'm way more down with the live thing. Like the studio is great, but we're always trying to get the live sound in the studio, so it's much easier just to do it live.
I feel like I learn a lot in the studio about the songs, and I come out with a different, like, more developed idea. So, like, I'll have something that I'm doing live, and it might kind of noodle around, and then when I go into the studio, I can kind of cement what I'm doing and find, like, a clear way to play the song.
Now, do you all, you know, contribute to the songwriting, or...?
Yeah.
Yeah, the three of us have written most of the songs all together. Sometimes one person will bring, you know, a chord progression to the table, and then we'll all maybe change it around, and then V and I will add some lyrics, or sometimes somebody will come with just lyrics, and then we'll find chords that work. But or sometimes we'll sit down, the three of us, and just all write it all at once together.
Somebody write a line, give it to the next person, they write a line, give it to the next person.
Yeah, we've done that game.
Game at games.
Usually,
you know, not being a songwriter, but I've, of course, listened to a lot of songs, but the I had heard, you know, like Mick Jagger talking about songwriting. They asked him if he actually writes with Keith Richards, and he says that he doesn't actually write with him. You know, he says, you know, he goes, I'm only in a room with him as much as I have to be. But, you know, what he said, he goes, I'll give you an example. Our songwriting is, he goes, Sympathy for the Devil. He said, you know, Jagger said that. He goes, I wrote that song, and I wrote it on an acoustic guitar, and it was more of a country song. He goes, and I played it for Keith, and I showed it to him. And he said, oh, no, mate, you know, you got to change this around. And how about if you just go, yow, you know what I mean? Because by the time you got done with it, it was a completely different song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you guys do that things like that similar?
Definitely.
Yeah,
a couple of our heaviest rock songs started as acoustic, you know, not ballads, but, you know, just eclectic songs. And then V gets a hold of them. And
yeah, we write most of our songs just with a couple guitars. We used to go sit by Ashen Creek. In the summer and just write songs, or we'd go up in the hills and just start that way. And then when we get, you know, with the drums and the bass plugged in, it always changes.
Yeah.
Do you guys find writing, you know, does it come like easy to you, or is it like, you know, a labor of love?
Comes pretty easy to us. We have a good chemistry.
Yeah.
Between us, sometimes it's hard.
Yeah. Sometimes you're kind of disagreeing, and you have something that you want to be in the song, and somebody else is like, "Well, I'm feeling it differently." It's like trying to navigate and compromise.
Yeah, and we're pretty good at that compromise too. I'd say we've found a really good balance there over the years.
Okay.
Kind of trust each other.
Yeah. But the music comes easily to us. That part's not hard. It's more the fine-tuning.
The fine-tuning, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, when we sit down and write a song, we usually come up with some good stuff. Pretty easily.
Well, cool. So speaking of fine-tuning, are we all tuned?
I hope so. Yeah. Our guitars were cold outside in the car, so they're...
a little angry.
They're
temperamental.
They're going out
for all our listeners out there, we had a power outage last night when our first night that really kind of turned cold here in Ashland, Oregon. Of course, not as cold as New York.
Yeah.
But...
don't talk about Sandy.
Yeah. Me and Sandy broke up, B.
Me and Sandy broke up.
Don't blame you.
Yeah.
So I guess the song we're going to do for you guys today is called Mateo.
Mateo. Can't wait.
It's a really interesting story about how this song came to be. Greta works at Caldera, and she was bartending. I guess I'll let you tell the rest of the story since I haven't
told
you. This was a couple of years ago. There was a big fire out on Oak Knoll on the other side of town. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, near here.
Yeah.
And I was bartending downtown, and this guy came in, and he was just... You know, he was really stressed out, and I asked him what had happened, and he'd lost his whole house, everything burned down, his pictures, his instruments, his
whole
computer,
life.
His whole life was gone. So we wrote him this song.
So that's what it's called. Song.
We still have to find him.
Yes.
Yeah, Mateo. Mateo, whatever your name is. The song's for you, buddy.
He's a school teacher.
Oh, okay.
In Medford.
We'll find him.
All right, well, let's hear it. Mateo from Lost Maven.
Thank you. passed his feet. He said, this time life's gone too far, and I just can't believe. The fire came and took everything that I thought I could keep. The bartender said, hey man, you know tonight, this one's on me. Tried and true, it's been that way since the beginning of time. It's always there and it's meant to remind that sometimes it's beyond all control how the story unfolds. A talisman slips between the fingers of time, but here
Wow, that was great, man. You guys really, really sound great.
I just want to dedicate that to all those people on the East Coast that are having troubles and having their home right now, too. So
oh, no,
damaged homes. everywhere.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going around, and yeah, I'm sure they really appreciate it. Yeah. It's a beautiful song. Beautiful
blessings.
Song. Yeah. Well, I got to tell you guys, it's been great having you on.
It's really and, great.
And, you know, I want to encourage everybody to go out and pick up your CD. And you can get that CD on Reverb Nation. You can also Just Imagine It, Inc., where Lost Maven will be the featured musical artist. There will be links to all their different sites, Facebook, Reverb Nation, and
LostMaven.com.
And there's been Matt, Greta, and...
Veronica Rockstar.
Veronica the Rockstar, formerly Hurricane Sandy.
Charlie!
And your drummer, unfortunately, couldn't make it, but maybe next time you guys come back on and see us again.
All right.
Great. We miss you, Scott. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Hey, Scott.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
To learn more about Lost Maven, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com.
That I wobbled in my walk and I'm trembling. That's right, you got me shaking. When you take me in your arms to talk romance, my heart starts doing that St. Rita dance and I'm fancying. Yeah. Oh, and I'm shaking. Early in the morning time, late in the middle of the night.
Organ Hill is this show's audiobook feature. Willie Black is a newspaper reporter who has squandered a lot of things in his life. His liver, his lungs, a couple of former wives, and a floundering daughter can all attest to his abuse. He's lucky to be employed, having managed to drink and smart-talk his way out of a nice, cushy job covering and partying with the politicians down at the Capitol. Now he's back on a night cop's beat, right where he started when he came to work for the Richmond paper almost 30 years ago. The truth is out there, and Willie Black's going to dig it up, or die trying.
Another squad car was charging up, all blue lights and siren, plowing up the farmer's field. The first deputy looked a little queasy. He led the others down to the South Anna, and they didn't object when I followed. The mud was thick and gummy, almost sucking my shoes off my feet. She'd gone missing 4 days before, and her body looked as if it had spent every bit of 4 days being ravaged by nature. Most of her clothes were still intact, but there was bloating, and what must have been damaged by animals. At first, I didn't even notice, because of the way she was. Her body was pointed down, into the water, and her shoulders were bent over the tree branch that had caught her. Nobody was supposed to touch her until the medical examiner arrived, but one of the kid deputies in the second cop car waded in, unable to restrain himself, I guess. Only when he moved her body a little, causing the torso to bob more upright, did I and the kid see it. "Oh, sh," he said, then turned around and threw up, mostly not on his shoes. The first deputy was standing next to me, just looking across the river. He never said anything the whole time I was there. I see the dead, and soon to be dead all the time. I've witnessed often the damage that bullets do to soft tissue. This was different. This was like the 2-year-old East End kid last year, who was running toward her older sister inside the row house, when a bullet, meant to scare some teenage drug dealer standing on the street outside, tore through the flimsy walls and ruptured her heart. This was the slaughter of an innocent. "Why?" the kid deputy asked, as he tried to wash vomit off his shoes. And he didn't have to finish the sentence. Everyone understood the question. Why would anyone abduct a young girl, kill her, and pitch her body into the South Anna River to be ravaged by the birds and rats? And why, in the name of Christ, would he cut her head off?
Character-driven crime fiction executed with style, says Booklist. Howard Owen is a novelist and journalist living in Fredericksburg, Virginia, where he and his wife, Karen, are editors for the Freelance Star. His novels include Little John, Fat Lightning, Rock of Ages, and The Reckoning. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to blackstoneaudio.com.
It's all cold down along the beach. And the wind's whipping down the boardwalk.
Hey, Cy! You know what time of year it is?
What time? What? Oh, Christmas time. You guys all been good and practicing real hard. Yeah. Clients, you've been rehearsing real hard now. So Santa, bring you a new saxophone, right? Everybody out there been good or what?
Get Behind Me Now, Stay There is a Just Imagine It Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
And I'm Charlie Stanton, and we like you on Facebook, so be sure to remember to like us on Facebook. We also want to wish everybody a great, great, great holiday season, regardless of what faith you are. Just enjoy the season. Come back and see us in 13 because we're going to have some great stuff for you. So in the meantime, get behind me.
Now stay there.
Oh, that's not many. You guys are in trouble out here. And you better watch out. You better not cry. You better not bow. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. Santa Claus is coming to town. Santa Claus is coming to town. He's making a list, he's checking it twice.